So are we live?
We're live now.
Okay. So I'll go ahead then. So greetings, everybody, and welcome to the Computer Information Science and Engineering Directorate's distinguished lecture for today. It's my great pleasure and honor to welcome Professor Alfred Aho to talk to us today. It's I hope he doesn't blush when I say this, but he's a true giant in this in our field, and we're delighted that he has the time to speak with us. He's the Lawrence Gussman Professor Emeritus of Computer Science at Columbia, and for his research achievements in our field, he was awarded in 2020 the Turing Award along with Jeffrey Ullman. The Turing Award is widely perceived to be the Nobel Prize for Computing, and this was a richly deserved award. So to give you a little bit of context about his accomplishments, I want to tell you a little bit about compilation. Now, if you're not a computer scientist, you might be scratching your head about what I mean by compilation. And what I mean by that is that the way computer programs are written, it's become so routine that people almost take this for granted, is that computer programmers write programs, and then they use a compiler to convert the program that they wrote into the actual computer instructions that the computer hardware can execute. So back in the old days, before compilers, engineers had to write these very low-level detailed programs by hand. And not only that, if they had an idea for a computer program and they wrote the program and then the hardware changed, they would have to rewrite it because the low-level instructions would be different. So people were interested then in enabling computer programmers to write at a higher level, write their programs at a higher level so that they could be so that they could be used across different computing hardware platforms. And compilers are what enable this now routine practice to take place. Now, the first compilers, including the famous one written for Fortran, required tens of person years of effort to construct. Nowadays, we expect graduate students in computing to produce a compiler for a richer language than the original Fortran in a semester. And so you might ask, well, what happened? How could we go from tens of years of effort to a student semester's worth of time? And I'll say that what happened was Professor Aho happened, and also colleagues that were working in this in the same field as he. They are, on the one hand, articulated the sort of foundational principles of the forms of programming languages and in a platform independent fashion, in a mathematical fashion, and they developed tools that permitted these mathematical programming language descriptions to be automatically converted into the compiler software. And so in a very real sense, the computing revolution that we're still in the middle of is due to the foundational efforts on automatic generation of compilers and associated theoretical advances that Professor Aho and his colleagues in this area were developed. So I could go on and on about Professor Aho's accomplishments and awards. I will note that he's a member of the National Academy of Engineering and has been served in the past as the chair of the Computer Science and Engineering section within that organization. He's also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Royal Society of Canada. And there are many more awards I could go on, but I know you're here to listen to him rather than to me. So I'll finish my introduction by actually commenting on the fact that Dr. Aho is a recipient of several teaching awards since he's been at Columbia. And I can say that graduate students of my vintage in computing have benefited massively from his pedagogical prowess in the form of the very influential textbooks that he's written. So I, my colleagues and I in graduate school, we used the famous Dragon book for learning how to write compilers, which Dr. Aho is a co-author of. We used his algorithms textbook that he co-authored with John Hopcroft and Jeffrey Ullman. And we used to joke that we were all students of Al Aho because of the tremendous influence that these very well-written and deep textbooks had. So I will turn the floor over now to Professor Aho, and thank you again for talking to us today.
Good morning, everyone. It's an honor to speak to this distinguished audience, and I would like to thank Rance for his overly generous but wonderfully informative introduction. I think he could give my talk just as well as I can, and maybe more informatively. But I was asked to show one slide about me, so here it is. I've been interested in abstractions and algorithms throughout my entire life, and I have been very fortunate in my career by being in the right place at the right time to have had these two interests nourished and amplified. I went to Princeton to study for my PhD because, as an undergraduate at the University of Toronto, I became fascinated with how the abstraction of Boolean algebra could be used to model digital logic circuits. I had started exploring how algorithms for minimizing Boolean functions could be used to optimize logic circuits. And I did my senior thesis in this area. And as a consequence, Professor Ed McCluskey at Princeton wrote personal letters suggesting that I should come to Princeton to study with him for my PhD instead of going to MIT. So I thought this was a no-brainer that I could go and study with this master of the field of optimizing Boolean functions at Princeton. At Princeton, I met Jeff Ullman as a fellow incoming graduate student. But shortly after I arrived at Princeton, McCluskey was hired by Stanford, but Princeton retaliated by hiring John Hopcroft from Stanford to replace him. John inherited me as a PhD student. For my PhD thesis, I created index grammars and nested stack automata. After graduating from Princeton, I joined the newly created Computing Sciences Research Center at Bell Labs as a member of technical staff. At that time, Bell Labs was a researcher's paradise. It was staffed by brilliant researchers, and it was teeming with fascinating research problems. And its reputation for hundreds of world-changing discoveries like the transistor, information theory, and the Big Bang was legendary. My first boss, Doug McElroy, the inventor of pipes in Unix and the co-inventor of macros and programming languages, hired me by saying, "Why don't you work on what you think is important?" And I said, "I think I can handle that job, Charter." Unix and C were being created in the Computing Sciences Research Center, so the atmosphere was very fertile for somebody who was interested in abstractions and algorithms for programming languages and compilers. My Bell Labs experience led me to recommend to new students that for their first job, they should choose a place where they can work with the best people in their chosen field. You learn so much by working and talking to the people who are at the forefront of their fields. You are then well positioned for selecting your second and third jobs. Okay, enough about me. Let's turn to abstractions and algorithms, the two pillars of computer science and computational thinking. Throughout my career, I have felt that abstractions are a valuable way for describing any field of human endeavor. In the early 1990s, Jeff Ullman and I wrote a textbook for the first course in computer science. The first chapter was titled Computer Science, the Mechanization of Abstraction. In it, we said, computer science is a science of abstraction, creating the right model for thinking about a problem and devising appropriate mechanizable techniques to solve it. The appropriate mechanizable techniques are, of course, algorithms, the subject of a textbook that John Hopcroft, Jeff Ullman, and I had written 2 decades earlier. This book, The Design and Analysis of Computer Algorithms, had become one of the most cited books in computer science and was widely used in newly created algorithms courses in universities around the world. Bill Baker, the president of Bell Labs in the 1970s, had me teach a televised 10-week algorithms course out of this book to all the engineers at Bell Labs. He was very prescient. He said to me, "Al, keep working on those algorithms. They will be important someday." In 2006, Jeanette Wing, a former AD of size and now an executive director for research at Columbia, wrote a highly influential paper in the communications of the ACM titled Computational Thinking. In it, she said, computational thinking is as important as the 3 R's to every child's education. Since that time, computational thinking has become a topic of considerable interest in educational circles, particularly in STEM education. The precise definition of computational thinking is still evolving. This is how I defined computational thinking in a paper I published in the Computer Journal a decade ago. I said, computational thinking consists of the thought processes in formulating problems using abstractions so that their solutions can be represented as computational steps and algorithms. In order to facilitate communication, I like to use terms that have precise definitions. Unfortunately, although abstractions are used in almost every field of human endeavor, the term abstraction does not have a standard definition. So here is the definition of an abstraction that Jeff Ullman and I used in our Turing Award paper in the CACM. We defined an abstraction as a mathematical model with 2 components, a data model and a set of operations for manipulating the data in that model. You can think of the set of operations as the programming language of the abstraction. What differentiates abstractions in computer science from other fields is that in computer science, an abstraction comes with the set of operations. And I think a simple example should clarify what we were trying to get at with our definition of an abstraction. Let's consider the dictionary abstraction in computer science. It has a data model consisting of a universal set of elements U and a subset U. And there are 3 operations, inserting an element into the subset, deleting an element from the subset, and looking up to see if an element is contained in that subset. The programming language associated with the dictionary consists of straight line sequences of these 3 operations. And the dictionary abstraction is widely used. It is commonly used to model the symbol table inside a compiler, where U is the set of all possible character strings and S is the set of currently valid variable names in a program as the program is compiled. Let's talk about algorithms for a minute. I'm sure all of you know what an algorithm is. Informally, you can say an algorithm is a recipe for doing something. My mother liked that definition. In computer science, we can formally define an algorithm as a Turing machine that halts on all inputs. I note with some chagrin that some computer science textbooks do not require an algorithm to halt on all inputs. But in all of the books that I have written, I have always used Don Knuth's definition, which requires an algorithm to halt on all inputs. In the books that I have written, I called an algorithm a procedure that did not halt on all inputs a procedure rather than an algorithm. And this distinction between algorithms and procedures is very much like the distinction between total recursive functions and partial recursive functions in recursive function theory. After defining an abstraction, Jeff and I started to create a rudimentary taxonomy for computer science abstractions based on their purpose. We began with four categories that are useful in the design of programming language translators: fundamental abstractions, abstract implementations, declarative abstractions, and computational abstractions. I will say a few words about each of these four categories. Our first category, the fundamental abstractions, are basic standalone abstractions like stacks and queues, or abstractions like graphs and trees that are often embedded in a general purpose programming language. Our second category we called abstract implementations. These are data structures like hash tables and search trees that are useful for implementing fundamental abstractions. An abstract implementation may have several different instantiations with wildly different running times at the machine level. Our third category we called declarative abstractions. Their purpose is to raise the level of programming. Good examples from compiler design are regular expressions, context-free grammars, and flow graphs. And I will say a few words about each of these three abstractions shortly. Our fourth category we called the computational abstractions. These include models of actual computers like the random access machine, or theoretical models of computation like Turing machines, Boolean circuits, and quantum circuits. I should point out that there is enormous diversity in computer science abstractions, and our taxonomy is far from complete. We invite you to add useful categories to it. An important property of abstractions is that they can be layered. We can implement one abstraction in terms of other abstractions. For example, we can implement a dictionary in terms of other abstractions, such as linked lists or hash tables. We can implement an abstraction on a computer with different algorithms, which may impute vastly different running times for the abstraction. For example, regular expressions can be implemented in linear time with non-deterministic finite automa, or in exponential time with deterministic finite automata. To highlight the importance of abstractions and algorithms, I will illustrate how they have transformed the field of compiler design from an art to a science, substantiating the comments that Rance made in his introduction. To simplify the discussion, let's define a compiler as a program that translates a source program in one programming language into a semantically equivalent target program in some other language. A significant contribution to compiler design occurred when we started thinking of a compiler as a composition of phases that translate the source program into a sequence of semantically equivalent representations from which the target program is finally generated. The phases shown in violet in this slide are called the front end of the compiler, and the phases in blue, the back end. The modern compiler framework, LLVM, allows one of several different front ends to translate a given programming language into a single intermediate representation called LLVM IR. The front end is followed by a code optimizer that transforms the intermediate representation into a version from which a better target program can be produced by one of several different target language code generators that can be used in the back end. Each of these phases of a compiler uses distinctive abstractions. I will now describe in more detail how the three declarative abstractions, regular expressions, context-free grammars, and flow graphs are used in compilers. Let's begin by looking at regular expressions as a declarative abstraction for lexical analysis, the first phase of a compiler. The data model of the regular expression abstraction is sets of strings over some finite alphabet. The operations of the abstraction are union, concatenation, and cleany star on sets of strings. Regular expressions were invented by Stephen Kleene in 1951, and they are now routinely used in a variety of forms in many string pattern matching programs and languages such as grep, awk, lex, and Perl. There are several different algorithms for implementing regular expression pattern matchers with wildly different running times. In the late 1960s, Ken Thompson at Bell Labs used a just-in-time simulation of a non-deterministic finite automaton in his grep program to search for regular expression patterns in an input string in time that is linear in the product of the length of the regular expression times the length of the input string. In the early 1970s, I created a regular expression search program on Unix called eGrep that used a dynamic lazy construction of DFA deterministic finite automaton transitions to recognize regular expression patterns in time that was observed in practice to be linear in the sum of the length of the regular expression plus the length of the input string. My boss, Doug McElroy, was interested in, had a program that dealt with dates, and he had a very large collection of regular expression patterns that could be used to specify dates in different formats. And when I had originally used the standard subset construction to convert an NFA to a DFA to implement my eGrep program, it took a long time to construct the deterministic finite automaton. But when it was constructed, the deterministic finite automaton could be run very, very quickly. However, the process was somewhat like constructing a Boeing 747 to go across the street. You spend all your time constructing the 747 and very little time flying it. So when I put the dynamic construction of the DFA transitions into my eGrep program, the eGrep ran amazingly fast, and this made my boss, Doug McElroy, very happy, which was always good to do. Later in the 1970s, Michael Lesk and Eric Schmidt at Bell Labs implemented a regular lexical analyzer generator called Lex that takes a specification of a lexical analyzer and automatically constructs a lexer from it. Lex used regular expressions to specify the syntax of tokens, and Eric Schmidt, as a young intern at Bell Labs, put one of my fast regular expression pattern matching algorithms into Lex. And as you know, Eric Schmidt went on to become the CEO of Google. Lex is a tool that allows users to create efficient lexical analyzers from regular expression-based specifications without having to learn any algorithms for efficient regular expression pattern matching. As an example, here is a simple Lex specification for recognizing integer numbers. Fed into Lex, this specification produces a lexer that will recognize a sequence of one or more digits in an input string, install the sequence of digits into a symbol table, and return a pointer to the sequence of digits in the symbol table, along with the token num. Lex and its descendants like Flex on Linux are still used today to build lexical analyzers more than 5 decades after the first Lex tool was created. Let us now consider the next phase of the compiler, the syntax analyzer, or parser, as it is often called. The declarative abstraction of context-free grammars is routinely used for specifying the grammatical structure of programming languages. Surprisingly, the idea of a context-free grammar is old. It gets attributed to an Indian scholar named Panini, who used a context-free grammar somewhere between 400 BC and 200 BC to specify the syntax of Sanskrit. Today, however, various forms of context-free grammars are used to specify the syntactic structure of programming languages. In 1973, at the first Popple conference, Steve Johnson, Jeff Ullman, and I presented a formalism inspired by Knuth's LRK grammars for specifying syntax analyzers. The formalism was based on a syntax-directed translation scheme with semantic actions attached to the productions of a shift-reduced parsable context-free grammar for translating a token stream into some kind of output, usually a syntax tree. In our formalism, the productions of an ambiguous context grammar could be augmented with disambiguating rules. LRK grammars are unambiguous by definition. However, the grammars that we used with the added rules could be used to parse an input string unambiguously using a deterministic shift-reduced parser. And Steve Johnson, Jeff Ullman, and I described such a parsing algorithm in our 1973 Popple paper. Steve Johnson had implemented a software tool called Yak for constructing efficient syntax analyzers from this formalism. Yak allowed compiler builders to use easy-to-write grammatical specifications for programming languages without having to learn the details for constructing the parsers for them. Yak and its descendants, like Bison, are still widely used for creating parsers. I might mention it was Jeff Ullman who coined the name Yak. It stood for Yet Another Compiler. Lex and Yak can be used together to easily create the front end of a compiler. As an example, here is a Yak specification for a desk calculator that evaluates arithmetic expressions involving the addition and multiplication of numbers. By compiling this Yak specification with the lexical analyzer created from the previous Lex specification for integer numbers, we get a working desk calculator. Excuse me. And as Rance mentioned, it has become very easy for students in compiler courses to create compilers using tools like Lex and Yak. And I will say a few more words about my experiences in teaching students how to use these tools. Let us now look at flow graphs, an important declarative abstraction that is often used in the code optimization phase of a compiler. Flow graphs are used to model the flow of control in computer programs. Also at the 1973 Popple conference, Gary Kildall presented a paper in which he showed how flow graphs could be used to facilitate the implementation of useful code optimizations on the intermediate representation of programs by computing reaching definitions. So let's look at reaching definitions for a minute. We say the definition of a variable v from a statement s that defines the variable reaches a statement t if there is an execution path from the statement s to the statement t in which the variable v is not redefined. The reaching definitions problem is to determine what definitions may reach what program points in the intermediate representations. In the flow graph abstraction for reaching definitions, the data model is a semi-lattice of subsets of variable definitions in the intermediate representations of the program, together with a directed graph, represent the flow of control within the program. The nodes of the directed graph are the basic blocks of the program, and the edges indicate which blocks can follow which other blocks. Associated with each block are two sets of variable definitions, one representing the definitions that can reach the beginning of a block, and the other, the set of definitions that are live at the end of a block. There are two operations in the flow graph abstraction for reaching definitions. One is a transfer function that computes the data flow values at the end of a basic block from the data flow values at the beginning of the block. The other is a confluence operator that computes the data flow values associated with the beginning of the basic block from the data flow values at the ends of all the predecessors of that basic block in the flow graph. The flow graph abstraction allows a number of different algorithms with different running times to be used for solving the data flow equations associated with reaching definitions. I won't go into the details of this algorithm because you can find the details of this algorithm and many other useful abstractions and their associated algorithms for compiler design in a sequence of books on compiler design that Jeff Ullman and I co-authored in the span of 3 decades. The first book by Jeff and me was published in 1977, and it had 600 pages. The second book in 1986 added Ravi Sethi as the co-author, and it had 800 pages. The third book in 2007 added Monica Lam as a fourth co-author, and it had 1,000 pages. None of us had the heart to write a fourth book. These books quickly became known as the Dragon Books because all of the covers had a drawing of a fierce dragon conceived by Jeff, symbolizing the complexity of compiler design. I might mention the Red Dragon book was briefly shown in the 1995 movie Hackers, starring a young Angelina Jolie. When my two children saw the movie, for the first time, they thought their old man was really something. The impact of abstractions and algorithms presented in these books has been substantial. They have transformed the field of compiler design from an art to a science. And just to reiterate what Rance said in the introduction, the first Fortran compiler built by IBM in the 1950s took 18 experienced staff years. In contrast, starting from the mid-1970s on, scores of innovative languages like Brian Kernahan and Lorinda Cherry's EQN language for typesetting equations have been created in just weeks using the tools and abstractions documented in the Dragon Books. Don Knuth used EQN-style mathematics in his widely used tech typesetting systems. The books have also been used for decades in universities around the world to teach compilers to generations of computer science students. Let me mention an anecdote about my experiences teaching the one semester compilers course to thousands of students at Columbia for the last 25 years. In addition to teaching the abstractions and algorithms used in compilers, I had students form teams of 5 for a semester-long project that accompanied the course. Each team had to create an innovative programming language of their own and write a compiler for it. When I mentioned this semester-long project at the beginning of the course, the students said, "This professor is out of his gourd. Not only does he expect us to create a new programming language, but he wants us to write a compiler for it." But I might mention that in 25 years that I taught the compilers course at Columbia, never did a team of students fail to deliver a working compiler for their innovative programming language. I attribute this success to the tools, abstractions, and algorithms that we documented in the Dragon compiler books, and to the lightweight software engineering process that I learned working at Bell Labs and Bell Corps. I should mention that many of the languages created by the students far exceeded my expectations. And as a hint to those people who teach, I found that when I started teaching the compilers course, I gave the students a little language for which to write a compiler. And the students immediately came bored and said, "Why do we want to create a compiler for this dull language that the professor has created for us?" But when I asked the students to work in small teams to create their own innovative programming language of their own design, the students quickly said, "This is the best course they've ever taken," because the process of designing the language allowed the students to get to know one another, and they learned just as much by interacting with each other as they did from the lectures that I gave in the course. One memorable language that was created in the course was called Upbeat. With it, users could write programs to sonify streaming input data. The students who created Upbeat demonstrated their language by writing an Upbeat program that would play user-selected music triggered by user-specified patterns in the input data. They illustrated their program by taking the New York Stock Exchange ticker tape feed and having their compiled target program play music fitted to the patterns in the ticker tape data. When the market was going up, the music was bouncy and lively. When the market was going down, it was gloomy and somber. Their theory was that a stockbroker would rather listen to music that would indicate which way the market was going rather than staring at the ticker tape all day. I might mention that one of the students on the Upbeat team was Adrian Weller, who was a stockbroker before he came to Columbia as a PhD student. Adrian is now a principal research fellow at the University of Cambridge. For the last part of my talk, I'd like to mention a few unusual abstractions in quantum programming languages to show abstractions that are vastly different from abstractions appearing in traditional programming languages. However, the point I'd like to make is the framework and tools that we created for designing compilers for traditional programming language can be applied equally well to create compilers for quantum programming languages, even with these weird abstractions. I will begin by reviewing the four postulates of quantum mechanics, a fundamental theory in physics developed in the early part of the 20th century that describes the physical properties of nature at the scale of atoms and subatomic particles. From these postulates, we can derive the laws underlying quantum computing and quantum computation. And I'm going to use these postulates to derive the abstraction of quantum circuits, one of the key models of computation underlying quantum programming languages. And I'm going to follow the treatment in Nielsen Chung's classic book, Quantum Computation and Quantum Information. The first postulate states that the state of an isolated physical system can be described by a unit vector in a Hilbert space, which is a complex vector space with an inner product. From this postulate, we can derive the notion of a quantum bit called a qubit, which is a unit vector in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. The state of a qubit psi can be represented as shown by a linear combination of the computational basis states ket 0 and ket 1, where the coefficients alpha and beta are complex numbers such that the squares of their absolute sum of the squares of their absolute values is 1. The strings surrounded by the funny brackets represent vectors called kets using Paul Dirac's widely used Braket notation in quantum mechanics. Ket 0 represents the unit vector 1, 0, and ket 1, the unit vector 0, 1. These two vectors are computational basis vectors of a complex two-dimensional Hilbert space. It is important to note that a qubit is fundamentally different from a bit in classical computing. It represents a quintessential property of quantum mechanics. The state of a qubit is a superposition, a complex linear combination of two basis states. Postulate 2 states that the evolution of the state of a closed quantum system from one time to another can be represented by a unitary operator. And for the purposes of this talk, you can think of a unitary operator just as a complex square matrix whose rows and columns are orthonormal. A unitary operator represents a rotation of the state vector in Hilbert space. Unitary operators are reversible. In contrast, operators in classical programming languages do not have to be reversible. The single qubit Hadamard operator is a useful unitary operator that appears in many quantum algorithms. If we apply the Hadamard operator to the computational basis state ket zero, we get a quantum state, which is the superposition ket zero plus ket one divided by the square root of two. And if we apply it to the Hadamard operator to ket one, we get the superposition ket zero minus ket one divided by the square root of two. The two qubit control knot operator, C knot for short, is also used in many quantum algorithms. It has two input qubits, namely a control qubit C and a target qubit T. It flips the value of the target qubit if and only if the control qubit has the value one. The value of the control qubit is not changed. So here you see if the C is equal to the qubit one and T is equal to the qubit zero, then on the output side, C retains the value ket one, but the target qubit has now been flipped to one, the sum mod two of zero and one. Postulate 3 says the only way to get information out of a quantum system is to measure it. A measurement returns an outcome with some probability. The sum of the probabilities of the possible outcomes is one. A measurement is not a unitary operator because it collapses the state of a quantum system. And there are many different kinds of measurements that can be used. As an example, let us consider the projective measurement of a single qubit psi equal to alpha times ket zero plus beta times ket one. You would like to get the amplitudes of psi as an outcome, but in the world of quantum physics, you can only get one classical bit, a zero or one, as an outcome. The probability of getting zero is the absolute value of alpha squared. The probability of getting one is the absolute value of beta squared. Moreover, if the outcome is one, the state after measurement has collapsed to ket zero. Likewise, if the outcome is one, the state after measurement has collapsed to ket one. And measurement is a quintessential bottleneck to quantum computing because you can only get a classical bit as output from any measurement that you can produce. The fourth postulate says the state space of a composite system is a tensor product of the state spaces of its component systems. And just as an illustration in this slide, I've shown that if we take the tensor product of the two-dimensional vectors, A and B, then we get a four-dimensional vector. If we take the tensor product of the three two-dimensional vectors, A, B, and C, we get an eight-dimensional vector. What postulate 4 shows is that if we add a single qubit to a quantum system, we double the dimension of its state space. So if we combine n single qubit quantum systems, we get a quantum system with a state space of dimension 2 to the n. Note that if we combine just 300 single qubit systems, we get a state space with more dimensions than the number of atoms in the universe. It's this aspect of quantum mechanics that makes the simulation of quantum systems computationally difficult. Okay, we are finally ready to introduce quantum circuits, the key abstraction in quantum computing. Quantum circuits are sometimes called the gate model of quantum computing. They are a little bit like Boolean circuits, but there are important differences. A quantum circuit is an acyclic graph consisting of lines connecting unitary operators and measurement gates. No fan-in is allowed since logical OR is not a unitary operator. Logical OR is not reversible. No fan-out is allowed either because of the famous no-cloning theorem of quantum mechanics, which states that you cannot make a copy of an unknown quantum state. Here is a simple but important example that illustrates what a quantum circuit looks like. It has two input lines, X and Y, carrying the input qubits. The X line goes into a Hadamard gate, and the output of the Hadamard gate and the Y line go into a CNOT gate as its control and target qubits, respectively. This quantum circuit generates an output, what are called Einstein-Podolsky states, also known as Bell states. These states have another quintessential property of quantum mechanics, an experimentally verified phenomenon known as entanglement. As an example, if the qubits X and Y both have the value ket zero, then the output of the circuit has the value ket 00 plus ket 11 divided by the square root of 2. This state has the property that it cannot be expressed as a tensor product of two basis states. Such a state is said to be entangled. Einstein called the phenomenon of entanglement in quantum mechanics spooky action at a distance. I've shown on this slide what happens to the inputs ket 00, ket 01, ket 10, and ket 11, what gets produced at output, and all those four states are entangled states. In 1994, quantum computing received an enormous boost when Peter Shor at Bell Labs published an algorithm combining a classical computer and a quantum computer to factor integers with order n cubed operations. Many of today's encryption schemes, like RSA on the internet, assume factoring large integers is computationally prohibitive. We do not know how to factor integers in polynomial time on a classical computer. However, if we could build large scalable quantum computers with error correction, encryption schemes like RSA would be easy to crack with Shor's algorithm. But for the time being, no polynomial time algorithm is known for factoring integers on a classical computer, and we cannot build large enough quantum computers to factor the sizes of integers used by RSA in practice, so RSA is safe for now. However, as a precaution, NIST has recently initiated a process to solicit proposals to develop cryptographic systems that are secure against attacks from both quantum and classical computers. Several companies like Google and IBM have already built quantum computers with around 100 or so qubits, but to implement Shor's algorithm with full fault tolerance and error correction will require a million or more qubits. It is not clear when such large-scale quantum computers will become available. From a theoretical point of view, if we could prove factoring integers cannot be done in polynomial time on a classical computer, then Shor's algorithm would disprove the extended Church-Turing thesis, which states that any physically realizable digital model of computation, which can be efficiently simulated, on a Turing machine. So determining the true complexity of factoring is still a great unsolved problem in computer science and in mathematics. Scalable quantum computers are still in their infancy, but our abstractions and algorithms for building compilers for traditional programming languages have been very successful at constructing compilers for quantum computing programming languages. A little while ago, Chris Desforey, a graduate of Princeton University, came to Columbia as a PhD student to study quantum computers. After taking my compilers course, she decided to do her PhD thesis on compilers and design tools for quantum computing. As part of her thesis, Krista demonstrated the framework we've created for implementing compilers for classical programming languages can also be used to develop compilers for quantum programming languages. After graduating from Columbia, Krista joined Microsoft Research, where she is now general manager of quantum software. A few years ago, she and her colleagues at Microsoft created a quantum programming language called Q-Sharp that is now part of Microsoft's quantum development kit, which can be used to experiment with quantum algorithms and design tools. Q-Sharp is one of 15 quantum programming languages listed on Wikipedia's quantum programming webpage. To conclude, I would like to reiterate my thesis that abstractions and algorithms, the two pillars of computer science and computational thinking, have transformed the field of compiler design from an art to a science. And I leave as an open question to determine what new fields of human endeavor are there that can be mechanized with abstractions and algorithms for the benefit of humankind. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Hale. That was an inspiring talk, and there's a lot for us to learn from what you just told us. So we have time for questions now, and please use the Q&A feature to type in your questions. And what I'll do then is I'll relay the questions to our speaker. So we have one question already from Jason Hong. And it relates to machine learning. So his question is, machine learning seems to be changing a lot of software development from deterministic to statistical, where we train systems to have a behavior rather than building or specifying it directly. What do you think are the implications for compilers and for teaching people about computational thinking?
This is a great question. And if you look at some of the work that's being done in using machine learning to create target programs, it looks very impressive and very suggestive. However, the work is still in a rudimentary stage of research. And one of the things that I've learned sometimes from bitter experience, is that the programmer and the compiler writer should use the same definition of the programming language and traditional programming languages like Fortran, C, C++, Java, and so on, have international standards that specify the syntax and semantics of the language. So the last thing you want is the programmer and the compiler to have a different interpretation of the syntax and semantics of the program that's being written. Because as you're more than well aware, bad software can have catastrophic consequences, as we have witnessed, say, with the software on the Boeing 747 control software or other devices in which bad software has unfortunately killed people. And also I have a software hall of shame, where to get onto the software hall of shame, you have to have spent $250 million or more and produced a software system that didn't work. Unfortunately, it's all too easy to construct malfunctioning software still. And one of the great research areas in computer science is, how do we verify software so that we know it performs correctly? And one of the difficulties that I see in using machine learning to create mission critical software is that, how do you know what the program generated by the machine learning program actually does? I understand it's an open problem still in AI and machine learning to determine how exactly does the machine learning program do its job. I liken this somewhat to, I'm puzzled, very puzzled, as to how the human brain computes, interprets language, thinks, creates consciousness. And is this, again, a good problem for trying to understand AI better and what an AI program actually does? I don't know, but I think we still need to do a lot more work in understanding machine learning to know whether it can be reliably used to create target programs. That's my personal opinion.
Great. Thank you. So again, we have a couple of more minutes before our hour is up. So send in your questions as you have them. And while I'll ask a question, it's sort of related to the one you just mentioned, or the one you just handled. And that has to do with the sort of novel computing hardware advances that are happening now. For example, it's interesting to me to see analog computing making a comeback, at least in the driven in part by machine learning considerations, and with the so-called neuromorphic hardware, which is relies on basic physics to do computations rather than the sort of Shannon style discretized operations. What do you see? What impacts do you see these new hardware developments having on language design and compilation?
That again is a very intriguing question, because we really don't understand computation in all its forms. And as you point out, nature has been doing computation with models of computation that are very different from digital computers since the dawn of humankind. And I note with some interest that one of the great developments in biology was using machine learning to do protein folding better than biologists knew how to do. So the impact of machine learning, I think, is still to be felt, and it's still to be understood a lot better. You mentioned innovative types of hardware. One of the things I've noted is that maybe we finally discovered the Majorana qubit. Topological quantum computing is very popular theoretically, but people have been trying to implement topological quantum computers for many years. And it's only recently that people seem to have been able to create hardware that can create a Majorana quasiparticle. So this may create a resurgence in topological quantum computing. And as you may be well aware, that there is another style of quantum computing called quantum annealing, where the company D-Wave Systems has been purveying quantum annealers to the marketplace for more than a decade. And that represents a very different style of quantum computing, where you evolve the Hamiltonian to a solution. So I think this is why computer science is still a terrific area, because we have all these different forms of computing to understand better and to harness. So great question.
Great, thank you. We have another couple of questions that have arrived in the Q&A. We'll take these, and then we'll let Professor Ahill go eat a sandwich so that he can rest up for the next part of his virtual visit, which is the 3 p.m. Meeting with the program directors, which I encourage all program directors to attend if you're able to. So next question, what programming language is best to use to introduce computer science, in particular abstractions and algorithms as you've described them, to students coming from a non-mathematical background, such as social scientists?
Well, if I can give an indulgent answer to this question, back in my youth, Brian Kernahan and Peter Weinberger created a little language for routine data processing problems called awk. And awk was one of the most popular programs on the Unix operating system in the first few years of Unix because it was so easy to learn. It used a pattern action paradigm of computing. Human beings are stimulus response creatures. We hear a loud noise, we turn our head to see where did that loud noise come from. So the programming paradigm in awk is you write a sequence of patterns. Associated with each pattern is an action. And then you search a file of data. And for every line of the file that contains a pattern, the associated action is executed. And what I found was that all sorts of non-computer science people started using awk because it was so easy to learn. In fact, there was a manager at a AT&T Western Electric plant that used awk to keep track of the steels that he was producing in his plant, because he said it was so easy to write a database system in awk to keep track of the different products his plant was producing. That may be an extreme example, but the search for easy to use programming languages continues unabated. And I've noted with great interest that there seem to be as many programming languages in the world as natural languages. There are about 7,000 natural languages extant, natural languages in the Ethnologue database. And I once saw a website that had pointers to about 7,000 programming languages. So maybe there's something in the human condition that requires humanity to have 7,000 of anything until they're satisfied. But I think it's a good question on what to teach. I might mention that when I taught the compilers course, I mentioned to the students at the beginning of the course that in addition to learning the principles, abstractions, and algorithms of compiler design, you're going to learn three important life skills in doing that project associated with the course. The first important life skill was project management. Each team had to have a project manager, and the reason every team produced a working compiler at the end of the course was one of the ingredients of the grade for the project was, for the project manager was, timely completion of the deliverables associated with the project. So the project manager made sure that by the end of the semester, there was a working compiler. Another important life skill was teamwork. The students who formed the team were often strangers at the beginning of the course, but they had to learn how to create a software, non-trivial software system in a distributed fashion in 15 weeks. And for that, they needed to learn how to work well with one another. And the third life skill was communication, both oral and written. And as I mentioned, that one of the things that is required in the compiler business is you need a specification of the programming language that the programmer can use, and you need to use the same specification when you build the compiler. So communication amongst the team is a very important aspect. And what I did was I had the students write a specification for their language and a user manual for their language before they even began implementing their language. What use is there in creating a programming language that you can't teach others to use? So these are, I thought, some of the great benefits of the compiler course. And of course, you learn abstractions and algorithms, but now with compiler frameworks like LLVM, generating a compiler is more an exercise in software engineering, because you just generate a new front end or a new back end and insert it into LLVM rather than writing a compiler from scratch. But there is a great aha experience for students when they see their compiler working for the first time and the team celebrates. So the human aspect of creating a distributed piece of software as a team, I think, was a very important component of the course.
Great. So we have time for one more question. I know there are other questions in the chat. I'm sorry we won't be able to get to those. But the next question from Kumar Balachandran is as follows. Can you comment on the equivalence of data and function and how a compiler would handle abstractions that allow the data to change the function and vice versa? That seems to be the way biological systems behave, but something we avoid in practice.
Oh, another great question. I love these questions. My favorite abstract programming language, and not so abstract programming language, is the lambda calculus. And in the lambda calculus, it's the pure functional programming language. And the separation between data and function is very elegantly handled. So I suggest studying the lambda calculus to understand how data and function can be elegantly combined. Some modern languages don't do this nearly as elegantly.
Great, thanks. So I think that's all we have time for today. I want to thank you again, Professor Aho, for a stimulating talk and a very nice and lively question Q&A session. And I'll just remind the program directors that at 3 p.m., again, we have an hour set aside for sort of an informal roundtable discussion with our speaker. So thank you again very much, and thanks to all the attendees for your time as well. So
thank you, Rance.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.